Welcome to the Untold Tales audio anthologies. Written by Gil Schmidt and narrated by Melissa Del Toro Schaffner. Timeless Stray. It was said of the meteoric rise of Madame Franchot that she could read the future like an open book. Her fame, a matter of no consequence, when her East End parlor, a bare-floored hovel just 3 steps above the open sewer, was titled Reader of Tarot, became a matter of public talk when she moved a few weeks later, just blocks from Buckingham Palace and her second-floor parlor, a confection of thick rugs, dim lighting, and silver tea service, was titled simply Seer. The stories flew from lips to ears, and thus upon even more lips.
Unbelievable! The wench seems to have come from nowhere! Can you imagine? It was told she used to be a kitchen maid. Indeed! It is uncanny how she knows things. She sees them, like the devil, 'cause no god made that woman a seer, I can tell you that. It's Satan's work.
Madame Franchot predicted the sinking of that navy ship.
Madame Franchot told the Queen's cousin he'd be appointed viceroy.
She showed the Prime Minister how the elections would end if he backed the tariff bill.
She's not even French. That gypsy has spies everywhere.
I heard she's been seeing the Queen at night when the palace guards disguise her as a footman, and they sneak her in through the coal cellar.
She knows too much, and that will be the death of her.
Madame Franchot, whose Gallic nature was entirely dependent on her pseudonym, reveled in the gossip. The more outrageous, the better. She was certainly not above spreading some of it herself, dropping the tiniest of hints in her daily tea chats, and feigning a monumental combination of indifference and reticence when discreetly questioned about the revealed topic. As the days passed and her fame grew, the moments of conscience became fewer and weaker. The minutes spent before the mirror loathing her horsey features, dominated by teeth that were frightful in effect, began to fade into memory, as Rebecca Mudd melted into the past and Madame Franchot crystallized her future. The days of scrabbling for tuppence over a wooden floor and a heavy brush were gone. Her hands, once roughened red and calloused, had become softer, even elegant. The face, disfigured even further by malnutrition, smallpox, and early wrinkles, had regained a touch of whatever youthful luster it may have had, aided by fashionable wigs and the finest cosmetics of 2 continents. In the quietest corner of her soul, she carried the memory of that night when, after 2 weeks of nothing but water and scraps found in the slop buckets, she had done the unthinkable, offered herself to a ghastly derelict. Even though she pleaded for merely a shilling, the filthy scoundrel had haughtily scorned her. Oh, how that moment burned in her heart. In the deepest night, she would sometimes awaken to the crackling sound of that wretched laughter, that maddening sound that on her lowest night drove her like steely hail down the darkest, filth-strewn alley she had ever seen. There, humiliated beyond endurance, she flung herself atop a squishy pile of fetid rot and sobbed tearlessly. She recalled how the thought emerged unbidden, more like the end of a process, then a new thought altogether. Within that pile of putrid waste, there had to be something sharp. Her hands plunged into the morass and shoved aside waves of stench, her eyes flickering to and fro in the dimmest starlight. She would find something, anything sharp enough to sever arteries and veins and would add her filth to the pile. The faint whir frightened her. Rats! She scrambled back, gibbering, her pain fleeing in terror. For almost a minute, she breathed harshly, her entire body straining to determine where the rats were.
The whir came again, like that of an umbrella being twirled. Not rats then, but something else. Maybe something valuable.
Hope does spring eternal, and Rebecca moved back to the pile, aware now of its stench and chilly touch. Slowly, anticipating another sound, she plunged her hands deeper into the rot.
Whirr!
And her hands seized a box, vibrating slightly and warmer than the surrounding garbage. Out of feral instinct, she looked all around, muffling the faint whirring sound with her body. The box was made of smooth metal, silky to the touch, and its vibrations were now steady. Rebecca's ears strained for the sound of footsteps, more likely stumbling than steady in this part of London. Nothing. Scrabbling quickly to the edge of the alley's entrance, she peered up and down the deserted street, aware of the distant boisterous laugh of an illegal pub, and moved away from the sound, deeper into the city, where with care, light could be found and used for study. The gaslight near the park even had a bench. Rebecca sat there, tense, aware her time would be limited as bobbies and other miscreants made their rounds. The box sat carefully on her lap, its dark gray surface seeming to hold light rather than reflect it. About a foot long, maybe 8 inches wide, and 2 inches high, the box was not as heavy as the metal would predict. A knurled button was all that broke its smooth surfaces, and Rebecca first pressed it, then flicked it upward, but to no avail. Rushing, she slid her thumb over it to and fro, and with a sharp click, the box opened. It was the notorious East End that eventually gave her a home, one rented on a weekly basis from the meager farthings she made off small-time gamblers. It was often horses that they bet on, stumble-bum animals delaying the knacker for yet another week, but their attraction to hoodlums and bookies were the milk of newfound prosperity for Rebecca. And it was only several months of effort that she finally felt ready to transform herself, to rise above the mud, as she grimly told herself every night, and become somebody important. The box revealed its mysteries, with the reticence of a peer bestowing charity. At first, all she could see in the box were the vaguest of images, fleeting glimpses of people, places, and things she barely understood. Most of what she saw was simply unbelievable, like the huge silver arrows crossing the skies and wheeled carriages moving without horses. There was a sense of reality to these images that was very distressing to Rebecca, for she felt she could do so much if only she understood. The box responded to her touch and sometimes to sounds she made, but control of it was more chance than choice. Rebecca often went hungry in order to spend more time trying to make the box do her bidding, or at least do something she could benefit from. Her days were a quiet chaos of back-breaking work, scrubbing floor, or hauling slops, the minutes dragging their torment as Rebecca constantly feared the box would be found and taken from her. She often became desperate, panic-stricken, dropping her work in an instant to race off to the rubble pile or woodshed floor where she'd buried the box. She'd drop on her knees, willingly, breathless, scrambling at stones or dirt with her scabby fingers, her panic causing her to keen like a wounded animal, until she uncovered the smooth gray metal of the box, slightly warm to her touch. And only then could she breathe again, wondering what the box was and thinking how hard it would be to find yet another job. It was chance, rewarded by hours of effort, when one hungry night, Rebecca saw a list of familiar names, racetracks mounted in fairs, and of horses running for their very lives, races that had yet to run. Amidst myriad tragedies of humanity that flashed before her eyes, here was something she could use.
Excitement now churning in her gut, Rebecca noticed the dates and the names, finally blessing her drunken bastard of a dad for beating letters into her head so that today, tonight, Rebecca could read those names. She memorized several and waited. Oh, how she waited for the fair races of that day. Weak from hunger and ashamed of her rags and filth, she paid a boy her last 2 shillings, the pittance she had filched from her last job, to run between the fair and her hidey hole behind a pub's empty barrels. By the 3rd race, the boy noticed the old hag was smiling. He became scared when she got up after he told her which nag had won and started a crazy dance, cackling like a loon. He raced away, convinced the old crone was a witch. He even tossed the 2 shillings away for fear they'd be his death tokens. Rebecca cantered and whirled until hunger drew her short. Her laughter softened to a soft chuckle. The box was right! The box knew! Drawing it into her lap, she memorized a few more names, hid the box deep behind a barrel, and made her way into the slovenly pub. With a quick word in Lyspock's ears, she made her knowledge a topic of rumor, and beginning right there, a basis for income.
"It is preposterous!"
roared the large man, dressed in old-fashioned clothing, heavy in wool and dark in color. Murchison, his lanky frame moving smoothly, entered the office as Leeds blinked his response. The large man, his walrus-like mustache bristling in repressed fury, slammed his hands on the dark teak armrests and fairly burst to his feet. He whirled and pointed a short fat finger at Murchison.
"Who is this man?"
Murchison walked through the gesture and perched his hip on the leftmost desk, the messy one with the open gravitic condenser. He cocked an eyebrow at his partner.
"Sir Hawthorne. This gentleman is my partner, Mr. Murchison."
Sir Hawthorne Mallet, peer of the realm, former assistant to the Vice Chancellor of India, and most recently bandied as a candidate for the assistant to the Exchequer, quivered.
"I know nothing of this man. I shan't speak to him."
Murchison dug into his vest pocket for his miniature pipe, the tobacco pouch already on the desk. He snorted softly.
"Then you may depart with our best wishes," replied Leeds mildly.
Even Murchison paused at that. Sir Hawthorne sputtered and sputtered.
"Have you no idea of who I am?"
he barked.
"Of course I do,"
shrugged Leeds, fingering the Polish dagger he used as a letter opener. "But in our office, for our services, you must abide by our rules. I work nothing without Murchison, and vice versa. Now you agree either to that, and we continue discussing your situation, or you may depart, and we remain polite acquaintances." His stare was both ice and steel. Murchison started to snort, but covered it up by lighting the small pipe fitfully. Sir Hawthorne tried to meet the stare, but melted before its might. With trembling sigh, he plopped down into the chair.
"Very well, have your methods."
He waved a now feeble hand.
"Will you do me the favor of bringing Mr. Murchison up to date?"
A quick nod, and Murchison turned to listen.
"Sir Hawthorne's wife has been spending an inordinate amount of time with a woman known as Madame Franchot. She is a fortune teller, from what I hear. And somewhat accurate,"
Murchison said, punctuated by 2 quick puffs of smoke. Leeds nodded.
Yes, that's true. Except that Lady Hawthorne has become, shall we say, a devotee of this Madame Franchot, and is plying her with ever-increasing amounts of money.
"Bloody gobs of it!"
boomed the revived peer. "It seems this so-called lady of the future is charging money for her trivial pronouncements."
Murchison shifted his weight, legs now dangling loosely. "Many would say that predicting sunken ships and cabinet appointments is not exactly trivial." Sir Hawthorne waved a meaty hand.
Those were lucky guests. She has built a web of gossip mongers that supplies her with enough information for an educated guess. She's no more a fortune teller than I am.
The mustache snapped at air. Leeds plopped the dagger down on a neat sheaf of papers and leaned forward, placing his elbows on the desk. That would explain the fees she pretends not to charge.
She calls them donations, the strumpet,
blazed Sir Hawthorne. Both phenomenologists frowned at the outburst. You want us to prove she's a fraud, if she is indeed a fraud. Sir Hawthorne's face twisted in revulsion.
Mr. Murchison, barring her immediate deportation to Australia, proving she's a fraud would suit me fine.
The pause was long enough for a deep breath.
I'd rather see her dead.
The phenomenologists stared at each other. Sir Hawthorne, said Leeds, may I caution you about your statements? Leeds' eyes were sharp, his expression severe and grim. There is a barrister present. The peer gave Murchison a sour glance, then harrumphed.
I say that figuratively, of course.
His visage faded from fury to deep anger. The Persian clock ticked loudly, marking slow seconds as the partners peered at the angry man, bank account nearing red. Murchison's tone was soft poison, making Leeds shake his head in warning and resignation. Sir Hawthorne drew himself out of his chair, face mottled and stiff. Murchison kept his eyes on the peer, his pipe glowing faintly. Sir Hawthorne's fists were clenched until white, his stance a veritable pose of imminent attack. Leeds, still seated, shifted his weight forward, eyes darting left and right between the two men. One blazing with fury, the other burning with indifference. A deep sigh broke the moment, drawing a bushel of air through the thick mustache.
I resent the implication, Mr. Murchison. I certainly do. But I also understand that my behavior here has not been quite up to par. Certainly not.
His fists opened, fingers flexing to relieve the tension therein. He grunted.
No. My account remains firmly in the black. I want this nonsense to end, and that is why I have come here. I assure you that upon a successful conclusion, your fees will be covered promptly.
Now Murchison reddened slightly, though only Leeds could tell. Very well, Sir Hawthorne. We will begin as soon as possible. Murchison and I will arrange to meet this Madame Franchot and test her alleged powers. After a heavy pause, the men shook hands with tight awkwardness, and Sir Hawthorne, with a quick wave to keep the men where they were, departed with ponderous steps. Several seconds after the outer door closed, Leeds said, "Your mouth and attitude occasionally get the best of you, my friend." Murchison nodded and shrugged, tapping his pipe into the elephant foot wastebasket.
Men like him are like waving a red flag in front of a bull.
Leeds walked over to his partner and placed a firm hand on his shoulder. A bull cannot help its nature. You can. True, smiled Murchison, but it does liven up the day. Leeds' laugh was elegantly brief, though quite loud. The office door clicked open. Abilene, wearing an ivy and blue gown that did wonders for her eyes, swirled in, turning gracefully to pull the skirt and close the door quickly.
Randolph, you should be ashamed of yourself, she said,
hands on hips and a frown trying to crease her brow. Murchison chuckled and perched a hip on his desk.
Greetings to you too, Mrs. Leeds. Fine day we're having, one improved by your calling me Randolph rather than Beast.
Leeds smiled and walked over to Abilene, taking her hands into his.
You heard it all. What do you think?
Abilene gave her husband the fond smile she shared with him so often. I think Sir Hawthorne is afraid of this Madame Franchot. I gather she's raising hackles amongst others in his set. Murchison grunted.
I'd say half of Victoria's parlor is agog about Madame Franchot.
But how many are from admiration, and how many from fear?
Queen Victoria Randolph. The proper form of respect is to call her Queen Victoria.
Abilene glared at her husband for support, who shrugged a chuckle away. Murchison darted forward and made a quick note. August 26, 1881. A two Randolph day for Murchison. He glanced up, his face dark, with bright eyes. Under Queen Victoria's reign. He leaned back, the very picture of satisfaction. Abilene pursed her lips.
Your sense of humor fails to amuse me,
she said, with grand haughtiness to Murchison. Gathering her skirt daintily, she swept out of the office, secure in the knowledge that both men would watch her exit. The door closed gently.
Do you think you won that skirmish? Murchison glanced over at Leeds. Have you ever won one with her?
Leeds laughed. Not yet.
Murchison shrugged. Someday, one of us will.
The sessions at Madame Franchot's were always scheduled for early afternoon, around 2 o'clock. This allowed for her to rise at a decent hour, prepare her image with care and the help of two ladies-in-waiting, and to divine what would show on the always enigmatic box. Shuttered in a small room, where she kept the box hidden inside a heavy walnut trunk Baron Kensington had left her as payment, Madame Franchot began the morning's work. With delicate touches, she coaxed images from the insidiously puzzling instrument. Flashes of incredible imagery burst across the box's panel. Too fast for Madame Franchot to make sense of many of them. With barely perceptible twitches of her fingers, she slowed down the images, then shifted their subject matter and focus until finally, after nearly 2 hours of exhausting effort, she was able to see the familiar sights of London. Several minutes revealed little. A scandal in the royal family. A nephew of the Queen whose infamous fondness for Scotch whiskey was actually hiding a penchant for laudanum and opium. The imminent collapse of a merchant bank in York. And, Madame Franchot gasped. She saw her parlor, the very one downstairs, and the guests she had invited for that day. And a gun thrust at her chest, and the trigger pulled. Rebecca had seen her death. From sheer surprise, she yanked her hand from the box, the image vanishing into a nightmarish sense of burning buildings, meaning nothing to Madame Franchot when compared to the shocking scene she had just witnessed. Her heart was pounding, and her chest felt wrapped in steel bands, a dark sleeve, and a hand with a gun. That was all she saw, but it was enough. Her mouth went dry, and pain flared behind her eyes. She wanted so much to cancel the session, to flee from the scene she had captured briefly. But today was Lady Mallet's scheduled day, and she was always good for 20 quid. In Rebecca's mind, 20 quid was a fortune beyond ken. But for Madame Franchot, 20 pounds was another month of luxurious comfort. Despite her terror, Madame Franchot wanted to keep the money coming in. And so, with enormous will, she dressed, making the barest of conversations with her two ladies, and made her way to the quiet parlor. The clock struck 2, each melodic dong like a knife in Madame Franchot's spine. Rousing herself, she rushed to place the box at her disposal, using the trap door behind the armoire that no one else had discovered, and rushed back to her room to await her maid's summons. The quiet knock caused her heart to clench, but the image of money to be made and comfort extended gave her strength. Adjusting her dress in unneeded ways, she followed her maid down the stairs and to her salon. The visitors to her session had long filed in and now milled about, subdued as ever while waiting for her arrival, except for one tall man with heavy brown hair and piercing gray eyes. He was observing her closely, with a fearless gaze that she hadn't felt since her move to the East End.
I beg your pardon, sir, but I cannot remember your appointment with me today.
The tall man stepped forward a pace and replied in practiced tones.
I made no appointment, Madame Franchot.
I'm here in representation of Lady Jothwell.
who asked me to beg your forgiveness for her sudden ill health and my unannounced visit. His mild frown smoothed into a warm smile. Rebecca's hand fluttered, and she felt a tinge of fear.
Very well.
Her mind raced. Lady Jothrell was in constant poor health, and this wasn't the first time she had had to cancel her presence. But who is this man?
May I have your name, please?
I'm Randolph Murchison, he said. With a casual gesture, he added, shall we be seated? Madame Franchot nodded yes, before she realized she was being subtly manipulated. But the rest of her visitors, having deposited their donation in the dark wooden box outside the parlor, were taking their seats along the oval table. Rebecca saw that no visitor was wearing a dark coat, but as the shades were drawn, her heart leapt as all the coats became dark and ominous. Madame Franchot, cold sweat racing along her spine, made her way to the far end of the oval table. There, now enclosed upon a small platform, rested the box that secured her fame. No one could see it except her, and no one was allowed to stand or sit next to Madame Franchot during her sessions. The visitors faded into shadows as she took her place before the box, and her trembling hands activated the images. Colors and shadows shifted as Madame Franchot tried to coax clarity from the chaos. Her usual control was lost, a factor neither Leeds nor Murchison knew as they drank in the strange sight of Madame Franchot's actions and the whispered sounds echoing in the parlor. Ever so often they would look at each other, levels of surprise registering in their eyes. Suddenly, a subtle twitch clarified an image. It was that of a hospital, British by the nurses' uniforms, and within it, a man she had seen before was being tended to frantically. I see a man in a hospital. Madame Franchot cleared her throat as she threw her head back, the cords on her neck straining for effect. A soldier. She dropped her head forward to look at the image again, then shook her head violently. Yes, a colonel. His ear is scarred. A woman stood up, her skirts rustling as she let out a piercing scream.
My brother! That's my brother, Frederick! He's dying!
Madame Franchot's ladies-in-waiting rushed forward and did their best to comfort the distraught woman. Is that happening now? Snapped Murchison. All heads turned to him. The frantic woman took a deep breath, shuddering, clutching at Madame Franchot's ladies.
No! Frederick is at home at this moment, but he is scheduled to leave for the Sudan on the morrow.
Murchison aimed his words at Madame Franchot.
How can you be sure that the man you see is indeed the lady's brother?
Madame Franchot's face made the sneer more effective.
I have seen the scarred ear that Lady Tapenor knows can only describe her brother.
As Murchison stood up, she raised her hands commandingly.
Stop! The session must go on.
The other guests were anxious, confused, and Madame Franchot wanted to end this all very quickly. Murchison sat down, as if by stages.
How can you tell the hospital is in the Sudan?
His voice was a soft rumble in the darkness. Again, the sneer flashed forth.
I have seen the soldier's regimental colors, the red and silver of her brother's 2nd West Yorkshire. They are in the Sudan.
As gently as possible, he asked Lady Tabernor, Ma'am, how can you tell that Madame Franchot is talking about Frederick?
I can't,
moaned the woman, tears glistening on her cheeks.
All I know is that the man she is describing in that hospital is my brother.
At that moment, Madame Franchot saw the doctor slump back from his patient, his shoulders and arms dropping in the final gesture of impotence before the ultimate end.
The haggard nurse drew the sheet over the man's face. Madame Franchot's face, so hard and domineering, crumpled in unmistakable shock. In the tragic silence, Lady Tabanor asked,
"He's dead, isn't he?"
The silence answered. Lady Tabanor choked back a sob, stood up with the help of the tending ladies, and said in a terrible monotone,
"I will do what I must."
Stunned silence marked her departure as she left the darkened room, more wraith than human. Murchison used a moment to move near Madame Franchot and look within the small platform. The woman, still shocked by what she had seen, didn't notice him, while her hands, seeking solace, slid over the box's surface. For the briefest of moments, Murchison saw a picture of a field hospital tent, a bloodied doctor, and an exhausted nurse standing sadly behind a sheet-covered pallet. Then, as Madame Franchot touched the box where the picture was, the picture changed in kaleidoscopic fashion, images flashing and crashing into each other, one after the other. What was that box? Madame Franchot stirred, startled to find someone standing next to her, looking at the box. As she stood up suddenly, an image became clear. A line of black vehicles, without horses, people inside of them waving, moving along a sunny street, lined with spectators on both sides. Some of the people were waving back. Several men with shiny helmets were riding bicycles they didn't need to pedal. Before Madame Franchot could say anything, Murchison whispered fiercely,
"Where did you get that box?"
Suddenly, the door burst open and a roaring voice bellowed,
"Enough!"
The bulk of Sir Hawthorne filled the doorway. The attention of all but two people centered on the gun in his meaty hand. Madame Franchot and Murchison watched as the vehicles crept along, a woman in a pink round hat smiling as the man next to her waved happily at the crowd. Murchison shifted his gaze to pin at the intruder.
"Behave yourself, man!"
He spat at Sir Hawthorne. The peer's eyes shifted to him momentarily.
"Hawthorne, what are you doing here?"
Lady Mallet's voice cracked, her hands fluttering in fright and anger. Madame Franchot turned and gasped as she saw the gun, the arm, the dark sleeve. In the box, the young man waved at the people, the vehicles making a slight turn. Sir Hawthorne leveled his gun at Lady Hawthorne.
"I have had enough of this witch's interference. Get out of here!"
Sir Hawthorne swung the pistol up and aimed at Madame Franchot's chest. She leaped back, falling against the wall. A shot was heard. Murchison ducked and saw in the box that the young man twitched. He then leaped across the table, shoving it and chairs aside, slamming into Sir Hawthorne and knocking others down. The small platform tilted, turned, and Madame Franchot cried out as she reached to grab it. Sir Hawthorne staggered. Fire. Murchison felt the bullet speed by and hit the box behind him. He turned in time to see the young man's head explode. Sir Hawthorne saw it too, the tiny image so frighteningly real. His mouth dropped open, his arm falling limp as the gun bounced on the floor. Three pairs of eyes saw the woman in a pink outfit, the shockingly short dress splattered with blood, crawled desperately onto the back of the vehicle, and a man raced forward to stop her from falling off of it. The vehicle sped up and raced away as the people in the box and the three in the room stared, stunned, one of them shedding tears for her loss. Murchison picked Sir Hawthorne's gun off the floor and ordered one of the ladies in waiting to fetch a bobby. He stepped over and reached for the box, ignoring Madame Franchot's cry of despair, and with a brief touch, erased the image of speeding vehicles into chaos. The office was subdued, with Leeds perusing documents received from Hong Kong and Murchison trying to make sense of the day's events. Leeds dropped the documents onto his cluttered desk, their contents largely unread. "Do you think Sir Hawthorne's bullet killed that young man?" Murchison shook his head. "I don't even know if what we saw was real." "From what you've told me," said Leeds, shifting papers into neater piles on his desk. "You saw those vehicles, those people and their clothes. That is not our time. Could the box be a window across time? An open window?" He forced his hands to stillness. "It could explain the woman's uncanny predictions." Murchison looked at the panel on the south wall that hid the object in question. £3,000 to buy it. Silence and secure Madame Franchot's disappearance forever. He suppressed a sigh. "Let's hope not." The Persian clock ticked time, the relentless rush to the future. But both men remained quiet, knowing that simple hope could do very little against stark reality.
Thank you for listening. If you loved what you heard, please like and subscribe to Untold Tales on iTunes or your favorite podcast player. Now, you know that we love our listeners, fans, and patrons, and we know that you love us too. So I'd like to invite you personally to join the Real Space Insiders community on Patreon. I often get asked, what is Patreon? So Patreon is a membership site that helps support artists and creatives to continue to do the work they love to do while bringing you the products and services you love. It's what helps pay for my time so that I can focus on collecting, recording, and promoting original science fiction stories of our time. The stories on our podcast are literally being written as we speak and as we are listening. In the Real Space Insiders community on Patreon, you're going to be part of an amazing international community of fans. You'll get exclusive behind-the-scenes content that nobody in the world gets to see. Live narration sessions that I don't post anywhere on social media or on the internet or on my website, anywhere. You'll get behind-the-scenes content, digital downloads, early access to content coming out, including events whenever we have them, and patron shout-outs. And you aren't tied into any commitment, so you can stay and go whenever you'd like. So for less than 2 fancy cups of coffee a month, you can keep the stories coming. So go ahead and pop over to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/Melissa Del Toro voiceover. That'll be down in the show notes. If you'd like to read more of the stories on the Untold Tales series not narrated here on our podcast, you can find Jeff's books on Amazon.com in paperback and Kindle format. So those links are all in the show notes. Once again, thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful day.